talking with Larry Livermore, co-founder of the late, great Lookout Records. How did your background and your life experiences prior to 1987 influence the ethics and the belief system that guided Lookout Records while you were there?
It was absolutely vital. My experience, my pre-1987 experience, is probably the most significant. Will be some of the stuff that I describe in the two-page intro to the book, where I talk about growing up in a working-class family in Detroit, and seeing some of the, well, first the Motown phenomenon and the first early shows of the MC5, where it was like the first time it began to become apparent to me that you didn't have to be like some big famous person out in California or New York, that some, you know, ordinary people could create their own culture. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand it in terms of what would happen later, because like we didn't even have the technology back then. Like there was no Xerox machines and people couldn't make their own records and stuff, but it planted a seed. And there was another aspect too, though, that I was like, I had a big chip on my shoulder. It felt like, you know, and we got no respect because we were like this dirty industrial town, and I didn't like society. You know, I was a young hoodlum and a greaser, and then a hippie, and before I got to punk, and all of that I think led up to my idea that, like, you know, why wait for some big important person to descend down from Mount Olympus and say, okay, kid, I'm going to make you a star. Like, instead, why don't we make stars of ourselves?
Right. In the book, you talk about how a San Francisco journalist in the late 80s called Berkeley and the East Bay East Berlin. What was it about that place and time that helped create the sound of those early Lookout bands?
Well, I think that was part of it. It was a fairly drab working class place in those days, and the East Bay had kind of a similar self-esteem problem as did a lot of Detroit. You know, San Francisco across, you could see San Francisco across the bay. It was like the Emerald City, all glittering and glamorous, and the people there had like this big, you know, we were like the cultural center of the West Coast, or there, so they thought anyway. And you know, the guy, the journalist who had written that used to, like, write in his column and that he would complain, oh, I had to go over to East Berlin today to cover something. And so we just kind of had this attitude like, oh, yeah, we'll show you. But at the same time, and I think I mentioned this in there, that punks were conditioned from the beginning to think small and expect the worst. Mm-hmm. And that we never thought that anything we did could amount to anything, you know, that it would always end badly. And so I know one of the reasons that I fell out with my original partner in Lookout Records, David Hayes, is it used to drive him crazy when I would say, hey, this stuff is so good. I bet you it's going to become really popular. I mean, we could like become like more famous than like the bands on the radio and stuff. And he would be really grumbly about it because, you know, punks weren't supposed to think like that. Punks didn't want to do big stuff. They were like, you know, just going to be in a band and play songs for 100 of their friends. And that was like the right way to do it.
I wanted to talk about some of the bands that you guys put out. You know, most people never got the chance to see Operation Ivy play. Can you talk about their live shows, what those were like?
Well, I would refer... I mean, I don't talk extensively about it in the book, but I talk about it in a very important way because there very possibly might not have been a Lookout record if it wasn't for my first Operation Ivy show. And I was out of town. I heard about Operation Ivy forming, and people were saying, oh, there's this great new band. But I did not know, for instance, that my friend Tim, who then changed his name to Lint, was in it, until I got back to Gilman after being away. And I was just like, oh, cool. And then, so he asked me to stay and watch them, and I did. And, it was a kind of thing where it was, I think, maybe 3 or 4 times in my life that a musical experience has been like that, where just everything vanished. It wasn't even, it was way beyond music or theater or anything. It was like the gates to another dimension opened up, and I was like seeing into something universal. Oh, oh, oh. One of the most impressive things about it, and apparently a lot of people had this experience, because David, my original partner, went on tour with him, and he said, we got to these towns, like, you know, in other parts of the country, the record had only been out a couple weeks, and he said they all know all the words, but I don't think they did know the words, because the first time I saw them, I was just watching from the back, and instantly I like transported up to the front of the stage, and I was singing along, and I had never heard this band before. I had no idea what any of the songs were about, and yet I was singing along with them, as if I had known them all my life. That was what it was like. Another aspect of it was that, you know, it was sometimes it was hard or impossible to even see the band, because everybody got on stage. You know, sometimes the band had to get off stage and play from the pit because there was so much of the audience was on stage. There's one photo in the book that kind of captures that. It's just like you could stare at it for an hour and see all these different little things going on. And it was mind-boggling. It still is to imagine that we were there and we were part of that. For the first year, I don't think I ever saw them do a show that was less than just stunning and momentous. And another thing that David Hayes, my first partner, said, after the record out was recorded, the album was recorded, on all the songs but one, Jesse Michaels sings the lead, but there's one song that Lint wrote and called Bad Town where he sings most of it. Mm-hmm. And David says, you know, that's a really good song, but when you get to the end and suddenly Jesse's voice comes in on the backing vocals, it's like it jumps into this whole new level that's like almost scary. It's like so amazingly good. And it was true. I mean, they were all four of them were really, really gifted musicians, but I mean, Jesse, basically almost anything he could say or do would suddenly become magic. I think Jesse almost found it a burden at times. Like he said, geez, it would be kind of like he was Harry Potter and I'm like, I'm not sure I want to be a wizard all the time. Maybe I just like to be an ordinary boy sometimes. Mm-hmm. I think he was really troubled by that, whereas the other guys in the band were just like, this is so great. We always dreamed of being in a band, and now we're in like one of the best bands there is, and this is so awesome. And whereas Jesse was like troubled, it really disturbed him. Like, gee, I don't know if I want to be this special.
Yeah. You know, Green Day is obviously a really important part of the whole Lookout story. I saw in another interview that you said seeing them in a cabin in the mountains in 1988 was one of the best shows you've ever seen in your life. Can you talk about that?
It's in the top five. Well, I had never met the two younger ones. They were called Sweet Children still at that time, by the way. I knew their drummer, Al, because he had been in Isocracy, and we were, you know, more or less buddies. And by that time, I had already put out the first Isocracy record. But at that time, Trey was in our band, and he had just started high school. And he said, hey, you guys, I told the kids at my school that we would play at this party on Friday night, and it's up in this cabin way up Sherwood Road, which is like 20 miles from the nearest town. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. And then right after that, Al called me and says, hey, I'm in this new band, and they're really good, but they're not that punk, but they're really good anyway. And and, you know, we want to play some shows, you know, and we could play. And I said, well, there's this show. It's not really a show. It's a party for high school kids. It'll probably suck. It's like 140 miles for you guys to drive. The weather's terrible. It might not even happen because of the weather. And there's no money. And he says, we'll be there. And that's how they showed up. Five high school kids showed up. It was a very cold night, and most of them didn't want to bother coming up. And we had to break into the little cabin because the kid that had the key didn't come. And we started a fire in the wood stove and lit a bunch of candles for light and found a generator out back to power it. And these five high school kids, who I don't think none of whom had ever been to a punk rock show in their life, because it was a small rural town where they lived. And I just sat there politely on the floor, kind of like, you know, like they were all going to watch TV or something. And Billy and Mike and Al sat up at the front of the cabin. It was really about the size of like a small room, and played. And Billy like had this confusing combination. On one hand, he would be like this very humble 16-year-old, which is what he was at the time, like, oh, gee, thanks for coming to watch our band. We really appreciate it. This is really a great privilege to be here. And on the other hand, he would have sort of held himself with the bearing of a real rock star, even though it was like maybe his third or fourth show with Sweet Children ever. He had this kind of quiet self-confidence, you know. I didn't realize at the time that he had been playing music most of his life. I mean, he made his first record when he was five. You know, sort of his music teacher helped him make a record. And his dad was a musician, and he learned to sing all of the jazz standards and stuff that went like that when he was this little boy. So, but still, he had never done anything like this, the kind of music, up until just very recently. And it reminded me a lot of the Beatles, who, you know, because of my age, that's who I grew up with, thinking of as a great band. And I found myself thinking, these guys are like the Beatles. They're that good. This is like seeing the Beatles in my living room when they were just starting out, and that these kids could be that big. And, you know, and just like that, like within two or three songs, even though they had barely begun to be a band, I was like, I'm going to put their record out. That was that.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about one more band. One of my favorite records of all time is The Queers' Love Songs for the Retarded. Can you talk about...
I was there when it was being made, yeah.
Yeah, can you tell me a little bit about the making of that, and just... Those guys were totally different from the other bands you were working with, right?
Yeah, they were older, for one thing. All their bass player, B-Face, was quite young. I think maybe only 19 or 21, something like that. But Joe and Hugh, the guitarist, singer, and drummer, they were only about 10 years younger than me, which was older than almost all the other musicians we work with. And they had been out on the fringes of the scene for a long time. I mean, they made their first record back in the... Not their first record, but they'd been playing the songs that were on their first record back in since the early to mid-80s. But they'd never really gotten anywhere. I had a whole different image of them. I thought they were like some kind of cult hipster band that only like really sophisticated music fans knew about. But until Ben Weasel sent me their demo tape, and I realized, no, that's not what at all. They're more like a sort of Beach Boys meets doo-wop meets the Ramones kind of band, which I immediately made them super eligible for Lookout. So I can start making a rhyme, so I can start making that downtown trip. You know, it's starting to get old, if you know what I mean. You can scream and shout and it'll be fine. Give me a battle day and blow my mind. You can hold me tight and rattle my brain. I didn't realize that's kind of, I thought they were just some kind of artsy hipster band, and thanks to Ben Weasel, that, you know, I found out that they were somebody that, you know, really deserved and needed to be on a record. But they had led such a chaotic existence, and you know, drugs had played a factor, and partying, and also being removed from the mainstream punk scene where they lived, that you know, they just had been going along for many years before they finally got a chance to make a record that would get some distribution. Like, their first record was done on a obscure label, and only a few people ever heard it when they did Love Songs. Suddenly, look, by that time in 1993, Lookout had quite a large audience, and so anything we put out, people would at least check it out, and so the Queers quickly became way bigger than they'd ever probably imagined, and pretty much of a success story after years and years of futility.
And what was it like working with them in the studio, especially for that album?
Well, that particular album was, it was crazy because they could only get away from New Hampshire for 2 days to be in the studio, and they had to drive all the way there and all the way back. And basically we had to make the whole album and mix it in 2 days. And then I don't think B-Face was so much, but Joe and Hugh were like really pounding beers the whole time. Maybe B-Face was too. It was a very drunken affair. I think I was drinking quite a bit then too, but thankfully Mass Giorgini, the engineer producer, doesn't drink at all. And Ben, although at that time he was fairly fond of pounding a few also, he seemed to take his responsibility. He was the official producer, and although Mass Giorgini did a lot of it too, because Ben didn't know how to work a board, but Ben did have some ideas about how to make the songs sound good. Ben stayed off the booze for the most part. So luckily, and Ben was good at like telling the people, hey, all right, you know, enough clowning around, now sing the next chorus and that kind of stuff. So even though I think it was one of Ben's very first production jobs, and he and Mass Giorgini were friends and had worked together before, it all came together. But the other aspect that made it work so well, I think, is that the Queers had known and been playing those songs for a long time. So it was very much, it was a lot like when we made My Brain Hurts with Screeching Weasel. Now, Screeching Weasel came into the studio and they knew every song forward and backward. They didn't have to say, oh, how do you play that second bridge or whatever. They would just like bang, 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 and it's done. And almost to a fault, almost to where they could have maybe improved it by playing it a few more times, but nope, that's good enough. And that was very much how the Queers record was made too. Only the major difference being that Screeching Weasel were dead sober when they made My Brain Hurts, and the Queers were definitely not. But it was the only, of all of the Queers records, with one exception, that was the only time that they came into the studio totally prepared and ready to play everything. You know, the other exception being, that exception being the Surf Goddess EP.
Mm-hmm.
Even there, we had to come up with an extra song or two to fill it, but the main song was all rehearsed and stuff when we went in. But every other Queers album was kind of, to some extent, made up on the fly as it went along.
Mm-hmm. What, to you, during your tenure there, who do you think are Lookout's most underappreciated bands?
Well,
some more recognition.
It's, you know, should is probably a weighted word that I would hesitate to use, because, you know, what I think should be the most popular bands in the world, you know, you might hate, and vice versa. There's certain bands that I wish would have gotten a lot more recognition, but I got interviewed about this same subject recently. I honestly don't feel that there are that many bands that deserve to get way more than they did. It's, you know, you could say, oh, they were really great, but almost most bands that don't achieve what you think they should, there's usually some reasons for it. It's not just that they were unlucky. It's usually they didn't work hard enough or stick to it long enough, didn't tour enough, deliberately made their song, you know, swore in all their songs so they couldn't get played on the radio. It could be as simple as that. You know, all sorts of reasons. One of my favorite bands was a band called Nuisance, and they were from Humboldt County, up in sort of Northern California, not exactly a hotbed of the punk scene, and they were more of a rock band than a punk band. And they, I thought that they had a little bit of the Nirvana sound. I thought they deserved to be just as big as Nirvana. But ironically, their first record is just one of a kind. There's no other band that ever sounded like that. And I thought that, you know, could have caught on. But, you know, they were young kids at the time. And my take on it is that they thought, I mean, they really looked up to Nirvana. So instead of being their own band, they started to try to sound more like Nirvana. You do not achieve success by trying to sound like somebody else. So their second album was a pretty good imitation of Nirvana, but we didn't need an imitation of Nirvana, just like we didn't need an imitation Green Day. Like, once Green Day got famous, I had every day I'm getting demos with some guy, hey, dude, we sound just like Green Day, maybe even better. You know, and I'm like, well, we already got Green Day, so, you know, why don't you send me a tape that sounds like you?
Right.
That's part of my take on why Nuisance didn't get bigger. Another of my favorites was Brent's TV. Yeah. They were very quirky and very unusual, and yet they were just brilliant songwriters, and they had this, like, amazing bubbly energy. Like, they did most of their shows in parking lots and laundromats. I mean, I only saw them on stage maybe once or twice ever, and I saw them every other place. But I mean, there's at least two songs on that Brent's TV did that I think deserve to be all-time classics of rock and roll, and, you know, not that many people have heard. I think they might still be someday because they're re-releasing their stuff now. There's a song called Bright Lights.
Yep.
It's just one of the most impassioned and brilliant love songs, and, you know, kind of, I always thought it was about the town where I met them in Arcata, and I found out later that the singer, John Dennery, had written it when he was still in high school, and his girlfriend used to come over to pick him up, and he'd be sitting by his window waiting for the lights of her car to come down the street, and he'd know that she was coming to take him away. It's just got that feeling that just every you know, building up of that expectation and tension, and I can't wait to see her, and I can't wait to be together, and will it ever happen? Yes, it's happening. Oh, not yet. Oh, here it comes. That kind of thing. You know, the essence of not just rock and roll, but pop music in general.
The night is dark.
And they did another song called Trinidad, which was about it's about a little tiny town up in the north of California. But it sounds like that Elvis Presley song, Marie's the Name of His Latest Flame, mm-hmm. And it also sounds like a Smith song. It's got that kind of that certain staccato rhythm and that classic chord progression. Just incredibly catchy tune, but because the Brent's TV project as a whole was a little bit quirky and weird, it didn't get the audience that it needed. I think Pansy Division could have been considerably, they were pretty big as it was, but I think they could have been a lot bigger by doing two things, maybe being a little bit sort of harder edge punk rock, you know, sounding a little bit more like Screeching Weasel and the Queers instead of, their lyrics were a little bit too, I mean, as scabrous and scandalous as they could be, they were also a little too cutesy and, you know, a little too clever. Mm-hmm. And speaking of too clever, the Mr. T Experience, you have a genius. I mean, the guy is like, you know, every line of every song, there's like, oh, wait, I didn't notice that before. My, he's got all these, you know, double and triple meanings and allusions and stuff. And as I mentioned this in the book, you know, the British have a saying that where something can be too clever by half. In other words, you know, it's so clever that it kind of sails over the heads of a lot of people who might otherwise like it. And I think maybe that stood. I mean, the Mr. T Experience had a pretty good career, but I think they could have been like way, way bigger. She's got pretty fake eyelashes, expensive plastic glasses. Everyone who passes says she looks beautiful, but don't even think about asking her to dance. Cause in your sackcloth and ashes, you're never gonna have a chance. Sackcloth and ashes.
We don't have to talk about why you left Lookout in 1997. That's in the book. But I wanted to ask you: does part of you regret leaving it all in 1997, or do you wish you would have stayed on to see what happened those next few years, or are you pretty glad you walked away when you did?
Both. I spent a lot of years regretting and thinking it over and over, and like, oh, gee, if I'd only done this. And one thing I do touch on in the book is when it came down to the last couple of days, I was sitting there making plans to totally restructure it, you know, ask some people to leave and ask a couple new people to move in and get back to basics. Essentially, I felt I never felt the same about the label once we moved out of my room and into like big serious offices with receptionists. It just never felt natural or right. I would have liked to have kept things simple for forever, just like a couple of idiots in a room, like doing everything themselves. Some people, that may not be realistic. I'll never know, but I would have liked to have tried. But for years afterwards, I spent way too much time thinking, oh, so it's all so and so's fault, or if only I had done this, or if only I had stayed. I think it's possible that if I'd stayed and if I'd carried out my plans, I would have been fairly ruthless, because some people would have had to been basically said, told, get going, you don't really belong in this kind of a label. But it might have survived, but I think, you know, and it might be a multi-million dollar company today, but I'm not sure that I would be really excited about being part of it. I think perhaps Epitaph is a good parallel. I mean, that's a wildly successful independent label, the biggest probably in the country or the world. And it's very well run. They have had a lot of success. They put out a lot of records I admire and by bands that I admire. And yet it's not that much different from a major label, and both in the bad sense and the good sense. I'm not sure if I were sitting in an office of a label like Epitaph or even Fat, which has kind of had a similar success. You know, nothing against those guys. They've succeeded by working really hard and being ethical and doing what they believe in. But I'm not sure that would be my place, you know, that I would feel at home there. I mean, I felt really weird sitting in an office and having a receptionist screen my calls and being asked to make all these decisions, you know, so-and-so wants to know about the marketing. I mean, we're not marketers. I mean, all of our biggest successes, we didn't market at all. I mean, bands would come in and say, dude, how come we're not, like, selling so many records as Green Day? You should, like, put some promotion on us. And, like, you know what? We spent marketing, promoting Green Day, like, about $100, maybe $125. And that was to put a couple ads in Maximum Rock and Roll on the flip side and send out a few records to the local college radio station. That was it. And the same with Op Ivy. They sold all their records after they broke up. Didn't even play any shows. So that was a big difference. I felt like, you know, the music, if it's good, it sells itself. Some of the other people felt like we got to be just like the big labels and sell the stuff. I don't think I ever would have been happy with that. There's a quote from Brett Gurewitz in the book where he talks about how, you know, a lot of record labels aren't meant to last forever, and, you know, they just represent a moment in time. And I think that's probably Lookout. I think if Lookout were still here and were a multi-zillion dollar corporation today, it would probably have a lot of good bands, but it would also probably kind of suck. Another thing is that, you know, for my own mental health and for my own artistic career, I mean, you know, if I had stayed and was still a chief executive and stuff, you know, I doubt that I would be in a position to write books or play my own music or travel the world or study or do all the other things that give meaning and purpose to my life now.
Well, I just wanted to say, you know, for me and my group of friends growing up in Kansas in the mid 1990s, like Lookout was a huge influence on us and something we all really loved and still appreciate and still listen to all the time.
Well, that's greatly gratifying me to hear that. I'd like to tell you a little story about very early 1988 when we first hooked up with Mordam Records, who were our distributor and did an amazing job of getting us out to the public and making sure we got paid for it. There was a good guy called Tommy Strange, who was sort of the second in command of Mordam, and we talked a lot and just goofed off back and forth and stuff. But one day I was in the warehouse, it was not long after the Op Ivy made their first 7-inch, and I was saying, you know, Tommy, I think this is going to be one of those records that's like Minor Threat or the Dead Kennedys, which at that time was the mainstay of the underground punk scene. Was like, it's going to just like keep getting more and more popular, and like 20, 30 years from now, people will still be listening to it, and it'll be bigger than ever. And he just like howled with laughter, and he literally dragged me all around the whole warehouse to tell everybody what I had just, you know what Larry said, he thinks that that those bunch of dorks from Berkeley are going to be like as big as Minor Threat and the Dead Kennedys. Oh, and you know, and I was just like, you know, I felt like even a little bit of doubt myself, but I kind of had that faith from the very beginning, from 1987 on. I said, you know what, our bands here in East Bay and at Gilman are more exciting, they're making better music than anything I'm hearing on the radio or I'm seeing in the record stores, and if they're given half a chance, a lot of the rest of the world is going to see that. And, you know, to have people still interested, maybe more interested than ever all these years later, it's pretty amazing, but also pretty gratifying.
Here we go again, infatuation touches me.